This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran seeking urgent attention to Afghanistan's humanitarian situation, saying its frozen assets should be released to save the economy. The Saudi military launches large-scale aerial bombardments to target locations across several provinces in Yemen. Plus, a hunger-striking Palestinian in an Israeli jail still refusing to eat as concerns grow over his poor health. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Iran has once again called for the release of Afghanistan's frozen assets, saying the revival of the country's collapsing economy and saving the people's lives should not be politicized.
We call on the international community and in particular donor countries to live up to their responsibilities and extend new and adequate financial resources to Afghanistan laborers to help Afghan refugees and displaced persons. The timely provision of humanitarian assistance and the release of Afghanistan's frozen assets, which is essential for reviving Afghan's economy and saving people's lives, should in no way be politicized or conditional.
Speaking at a UN Security Council meeting on Afghanistan, Takht-i Ravanchi warned that the humanitarian situation in the country is highly alarming and should be addressed urgently and properly. He also said an inclusive government is vital to build a secure country. Addressing the same session, Russia's envoy to the UN said regional and extra-regional players all agree that an economic disaster needs to be prevented in Afghanistan. Vasily Nebenzia, however, said the main burden must be borne by those who occupied the country during the last 20 years.
This would be on the understanding that the main burden of post-conflict economic and financial recovery and recovery of development of Afghanistan should be borne by the forces and military contingents who were present in that country over the past 20 years.
The Russian envoy also reiterated his country's commitment to territorial integrity, independence and sovereignty of Afghanistan. During the session, China's ambassador Zhang Jun also highlighted the necessity of preventing the rise of terrorism in Afghanistan. He urged the international community to support efforts made by Afghanistan's neighbors to help stabilize the country. Political commentator Romero Funes says the only reason behind Afghanistan's current economic and humanitarian crisis is the U.S. invasion and occupation of the country.
The situation on the ground in Afghanistan is extremely dire. The sanctions and the blockade of Afghanistan from financial institutions are hurting working class families the most. People are not able to have their businesses run efficiently. People are not able to get the medicines and foods that they need to survive. And we always have to remember who created this mess. It was the Western imperialists who created destabilization in Afghanistan for many decades by funding the Mujahideen, by funding different groups. And now that the groups that the U.S. initially supported for many years in Afghanistan has taken power, and now that they no longer serve their interests, they are imposing this economic blockade in order to create a controlled demolition, in order to justify U.S. military invasion. Because now what they can say is that without the U.S. troop and presence there, Afghanistan is a failure, and this will be justification for them to reinvade the nations. And we shouldn't fall into the lie that U.S. occupation and invasion will solve this problem. It is that very same reason that these problems exist, and it is the U.S. that owes reparations to Afghanistan, not only for the tens of thousands of Afghanis murdered, but for all of the infrastructure that was destroyed as a result of this 20-year occupation.
Turning to a developing story now, Saudi Arabia carrying out massive aerial bombardments of neighboring Yemen, targeting multiple locations across several provinces there. The Saudi military hits positions in the provinces of Sana'a, Damar, Sa'da, and Al Jawf. So far, we don't have any information about possible damage or casualties. Riyadh says it launched the aerial campaign after intercepting a drone that attempted to attack the kingdom's Abha International Airport. A coalition led by Saudi Arabia waged the war against Yemen in March 2015, following the ouster of then-President Abd Rabbuh Mansour Hadi. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed and millions more displaced since then. Bring you more on that as we get it. Now, concerns are mounting over the worsening health condition of a Palestinian prisoner who's been on hunger strike for months. Qaid Fasfus is protesting his arrest under Israel's controversial administrative detention policy. His family has warned that he's facing imminent death.
Qaid Fasfus, a Palestinian prisoner, has been on hunger strike for 126 days to protest his illegal detention by Israeli officials. Qaid's brother has warned of his rapidly deteriorating health condition as he neither takes supplementary tablets nor agrees to undergo medical examinations. The emaciated prisoner has difficulty speaking due to damage done to his nervous system during the strike. Qaid's mother has also described the ordeal her children have gone through in Israel's prison system. Qaid is among the five Palestinian inmates who have refused to eat for weeks in protest at their detention without trial or charge under Israel's so-called administrative detention policy, something that experts say is tantamount to kidnapping and terrorism.
Israel, as part of this genocidal war on the Palestinian civilian population, kidnaps Palestinians, doesn't charge them, doesn't claim that they committed any crime, just kidnaps them and then tortures them. They call it administrative detention. Well, the real word is terrorism.
Miqdad al-Qawasmi, another prisoner who had abstained from eating for 113 days, ended his hunger strike last Thursday after Israeli officials agreed not to extend his detention without trial beyond February. Palestinian inmates regularly stage hunger strikes in protests at their illegal detention and harsh conditions in Israeli jails. What they are fighting for are their most basic and fundamental rights.
Turning elsewhere now, Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says Tehran is ready to fully implement the 2015 nuclear deal if all other signatories to the accord do so. Majid Tahtaravanchi says the U.S. must remove all sanctions in a verifiable manner before rejoining the pact. He has called on parties to the deal to offer guarantees that they won't violate their commitments again. Tahtaravanchi says Iran has always honored its commitments, while the U.S. and its European allies, France, Britain and Germany, failed to carry out their obligations. The multilateral deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, fell into disarray after the US pulled out of it in 2018. Iran has criticized the European trio for failing to keep their end of the bargain. Elsewhere, anti-coup protests in Sudan turned deadly again. At least 15 people are killed and dozens of others injured after security forces resorted to live fire on protesters denouncing the military takeover. Clashes erupted as protesters hit the streets of the capital, Khartoum, as well as the cities of Bahri and Omdurman. The security forces fired live rounds and tear gas to disperse the crowd. Some of the victims were shot in the head, some in the neck, and others in the torso. The protesters were chanting slogans against the coup and were demanding the return of a civilian rule. The military seized power late last month and arrested dozens of government officials, including the prime minister. Over 30 anti-coup protesters have been killed and hundreds of others injured since then. We have spoken to political commentator Abiyomi Azikiwe about the recent flare-up of violence in Sudan, and he is convinced that the brutality launched by the army against the protesters will not resolve the crisis there.
Well, what is going on is that the people are continuing to go into the streets, protest against the military coup that occurred on October the 25th. This is the second day of action within less than a week, and the head of the military junta, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, has appointed a new sovereign council, which does not have the support of the political forces that were involved in the initial coalition government that was formed over 2 years ago. He has recruited some of the previously armed opposition groups, for example, Malik Agar and others, and they have announced today that they're going to release political prisoners within 48 hours. We'll have to see if that's going to be the case. And he also announced, Mr. Agar, that there needed to be negotiations to reach a political settlement. However, with the brutality that's being launched against the protesters, what we saw on Saturday, what we also saw today, does not bode well for any genuine and positive negotiations to resolve the dispute.
Taiwan commissions the first squadron of its F-16s that have been upgraded with U.S. help in a new military cooperation that will likely draw an angry response from China. Taiwan's president says the project shows that her government and Washington are committed to their partnership. Taking the stage together with a top American diplomat at the air base, Tsai Ing-wen said more like-minded countries should, or would rather, stand on the same front as Taiwan and the U.S. Taipei has a deal worth $4 billion with Washington for upgrading its F-16 fleet. There are fears that Chinese and U.S. exercises in the region could spark off a military conflict. Beijing views Taiwan as part of its territory and is angered at U.S. military support for the island. President Xi of China reminded U.S. President Biden as they met online days ago that Taiwan is a red line for Beijing. The European Commission says COVID-19 cases are on the rise in almost all of the EU's 27 member states. High hospital admission numbers are putting health systems under pressure. Jerome Hughes is in Brussels.
St. Pierre has always been one of the busiest hospitals in Brussels, but now it is busier than ever. In the 24 hours up to Wednesday, more than 12,000 new cases of coronavirus were recorded in Belgium and 41 deaths. Even at the doors of St. Pierre, it's easy to find people who are vaccine hesitant.
I feel concerned for my part, but I know people from my age feel concerned but aren't really good with the idea of getting vaccinated.
I don't need the vaccine because it's 2 years there is the coronavirus, but I'm good. I'm very good. I'm not sick. I'm not, and my family is not sick.
COVID-19 cases and deaths are surging across the EU. In Italy, workers cannot physically attend to their jobs without a COVID pass. Experts suggest the country is doing better than neighbours because more children there have received the jab. In Austria, the unvaccinated have effectively been put into lockdown. Most venues in the Netherlands must close by 8 p.m. Hospitals in Ireland, Czech Republic, Bulgaria, and Romania are struggling to cope.
So the message remains clear. Get vaccinated. Maintain masks and social distance. Vaccination is necessary in our fight against this virus.
A fifth wave of the virus is hitting France, Germany, and Belgium. Health experts say there is still a lot about the crisis that is not understood. For example, it is not known why the vaccines do not work on 10% of people who take them. It is not clearly known for how long the vaccines remain effective. What is known, however, is that people who are vaccinated are far less likely to end up in hospital. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
3 years ago, the Yellow Vest took to the streets in France for the first time. And seemingly, no one could have predicted what happened next. Massive anti-government demonstrations became a weekly occurrence. But so did a state-sponsored repression, which would become historically brutal. Rami Mazahari has more on this story from Paris.
The Yellow Vests have marked their third anniversary, going from a ragtag group of gas tax protesters into a political force which has overturned decades of Western political norms. The defining image of the Emmanuel Macron era is undoubtedly the graffiti on the Arc de Triomphe, which read, "The Yellow Vests will triumph." That shocked the world, and then so did the once-in-a-century political repression, which gutted France's claim of being a leader in free speech and political freedom. The numbers were staggering. At least 11,000 arrests, 1,000 political prisoners, 5,000 protesters seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life, and 11 deaths. The Yellow Vests continue to redefine what citizen democracy is in the digital era by refusing to collude with the traditional hierarchies found in Western liberal democracies.
What we have done is provide a sort of national therapy. We made everybody, from politicians to unions to our institutions, fully aware of what a catastrophic situation France is in for the average person. 3 years ago, we took to the streets to demand economic justice, democratic justice, and ecological justice, and our movement has just begun.
Many ask what happened to the Yellow Vests, and the primary answer is that the massive state-sponsored violence and judicial intimidation, like the so-called anti-Yellow Vest law, scared the average person away from protesting. From June 2019 onwards, there seemed to be a blackout in French media on the Yellow Vests, as well as a massive censorship campaign on social media. After a year and a half pause due to the coronavirus, the Yellow Vests have marched every Saturday for over a month. They are expected to play a major role in France's presidential election in April. The Yellow Vests have proven themselves to be a new and entirely different type of political force. One which insists on inserting themselves into the political discourse, no matter how much some may try to ignore, silence, or repress. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
As the Zionist regime intensified its killing campaign in the Gaza Strip in May, people across the globe took to the streets in solidarity with Palestinians. Others used social media to document, condemn, and raise awareness of Israeli regime's crimes. But Meta and Instagram users soon noticed their posts being taken down, their accounts suspended, and their content receiving reduced visibility. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Tamara Nasser, journalist. This article is published under the heading, How Meta or Facebook Helps Israeli Regime Hide Its Crimes. Stay tuned for more. As the Zionist regime intensified its killing campaign in the Gaza Strip in May, people across the globe took to the streets in solidarity with Palestinians. Others used social media to document, condemn, and raise awareness of the Zionist regime's crimes. But Meta, or Facebook, and Instagram users soon noticed their posts being taken down, their accounts suspended, and their content receiving reduced visibility. A new report by Human Rights Watch confirms that the two social media platforms, both owned by Meta, did indeed suppress and remove content in many cases, erroneously or unjustifiably. But Meta's acknowledgement to HRW of errors and unjustified removals was at best insufficient. It failed to address the scale and scope of reported content restrictions or adequately explain why they occurred in the first place, the watchdog said. Last week, Facebook, or Meta, announced it was hiring an outside consultancy to investigate accusations that it was censoring content favorable to Palestinians. There is plenty of evidence of suppression for the investigators to look into. In the period May 6 to 19th, which includes the Zionist regime attack on Gaza, Palestinian digital rights group Hamlet denounced 500 instances of Palestinians' speech rights being violated online. They include removing content, account closures, blocked hashtags, and altering reachability of specific content. The vast majority of these violations, around 85%, occurred on Meta and Instagram, including the deletion of stories. Almost half of takedowns were done without prior warning or notice, and another 20% did not specify the reason for the removal. In one instance, Instagram restricted the use of hashtag Al-Aqsa in English and Arabic, which refers to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds. After Hamlet challenged the company, the hashtag was reinstalled. Hamlet also observed an increase in geo-blocking on Meta technology that restricts access based on a user's location. Some posts that Instagram purged were simply reposts of content from major media organizations that could not remotely be construed as inciting violence or hatred. But Instagram labeled them as such, suggesting that the platform is restricting freedom of expression on matters of public interest, according to Human Rights Watch. Even when social media companies recognized errors and restored content, the damage was already done. Human Rights Watch said the error impedes the flow of information concerning human rights at critical moments. The group called for an external probe into Meta suppression practices. In one instance, Meta removed a post by a user in Egypt with more than 15,000 followers. The user had shared an Al Jazeera news item about the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas. Initially, Meta deleted the post under its Dangerous Individuals and Organizations Community Standard, which prohibits specific organizations and individuals from having a presence on the platform. Meta later restored the post after the case was reviewed by its oversight board. The board concluded the post continued no praise, support, or representation. The oversight board also criticized the weakness of the policy and demanded that Meta explicitly define what constitutes praise, support, or representation. The oversight board is sometimes critical of company policy and claims to be independent, but alarms were raised last year when Meta appointed former Israeli official Emmy Palmer as a member. Palmer spent years at the Zionist regime's justice ministry enforcing censorship of Palestinians' speech. Human Rights Watch urged Meta to publish its Dangerous Individuals and Organizations list, a recommendation previously made by the Oversight Board, but Meta has consistently refused to do so, claiming it would harm its employees. Recently, The Intercept published a leaked version of the list. It names over 4,000 people and groups, including politicians, writers, charities, hospitals, hundreds of music acts, and long-dead historical figures, The Intercept reported. The list of those Meta deems dangerous largely coincides with those the United States and the Zionist regime regard as enemies, but it goes much further than that. It includes the deceased 14-year-old Kashmiri child, Mudassir Rashid Parey, over 200 musical acts, television stations, a video game studio, airlines, the medical university working, and a long list of figures, The Intercept said. As well as Hamas and its military wing, the list includes the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The Zionist regime considers virtually all Palestinian political parties to be terrorist organizations, a pretext to routinely arrest Palestinians for political activity. Even though the Zionist regime military regularly commits massacres of entire Palestinian families, crimes against children, extrajudicial executions, and forced expulsions, it is not deemed dangerous enough to make it to Meta's list. And the Zionist regime still regularly uses Meta to threaten more violence. For instance, the Zionist regime military habitually posts direct threats of collective punishment against 2 million Palestinian civilians in Gaza. In May, the Zionist regime war minister Benny Gantz used Meta to threaten more destruction than he ordered in Gaza in 2014. Back then, as the Israeli regime's army chief, he commanded a 51-day assault that killed more than 2,200 Palestinians, including 551 children. "Gaza will burn," Gantz said in a video posted on Meta in May, a direct threat that likely constitutes evidence of premeditated intent to commit war crimes. He says in the video over the footage of destruction, "Gaza residents, the last time that we met on Eid al-Fitr, I was chief of staff during Operation Protective Edge. If Hamas does not stop its violence, the strike of 2021 will be harder and more painful than that of 2014, he promised. The bigger question is why Meta, which has nearly a third of the world's population on its platform, is able to decide what or who is dangerous. It appears, as Columbia University professor Joseph Massad has recently written, that the criteria for who or what is considered dangerous or a terrorist depends more on a person's identity rather than what they do. It is not the act of terrorism that defines the actor as terrorist, but rather the opposite. It is the perpetrator's conferred identity as terrorist that defines his or her actions as terrorist in nature, Massad says. Meanwhile, as Meta cracked down on Palestinians, the Israeli Jewish extremists used instant messaging services to organize mob attacks on Palestinian citizens of occupied territories. This included Facebook or Meta groups, the Meta-owned service WhatsApp. There is no indication Meta takes this sort of misuse of its platform seriously, while banning Palestinian political groups, journalists, and discussion at the Zionist regime's behest. Long before the Zionist regime assault on Gaza in May, Meta was habitually taking down pages of Palestinian news organizations, often without prior notice or justification. Last year, Meta even removed a page of the health ministry in Gaza, a vital source of information for people there. It was restored following inquiries from the Electronic Intifada, but the censorship does not seem to be enough. U.S. media and political elites have been demanding increasing control and censorship of social media platforms in recent years. The initial pretext was the evidence-free allegations that Russia had used social media, including Meta, to manipulate the outcome of the 2016 U.S. presidential election to help Donald Trump win.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Torture, by definition, is the deliberate infliction of severe pain or suffering on a person for a specific purpose, such as forcing them to confess or provide information. But sometimes being indifferent to a harsh condition of the victim can also amount to torture. By many accounts, torture, in all its forms and shapes, has been a permanent fixture behind Israeli bars. But the question is, what leads to such scenes in Israeli jails? Every single day, Palestinian political activists get arrested by Israeli forces. It doesn't matter where they are, Israeli soldiers detain them at their homes, military checkpoints, or elsewhere.
Since 1967, there are altogether 800,000 Palestinians, men, women, and children, that have been jailed in Israeli prisons. And this is completely, of course, illegal. This is a way to terrorize and to discourage Palestinians to stay on their lands.
Sometimes heavily armed soldiers storm into Palestinian houses in the middle of the night to further intimidate the victims and their families. Most detainees are first transferred to unknown locations and exposed to a series of humiliating treatments, including assault, strip searching, and solitary confinement. In jail, the Palestinians experience every possible form of systematic torture, repression, and harassment. There are around 4,850 Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons, including 41 women, 225 children, and 540 administrative detainees. While these are official figures, activists believe the numbers are much higher. There are occasions an activist suddenly vanishes from the society and doesn't contact their relatives. For interrogating these detainees, Israel routinely used methods that constituted ill treatment and even torture until the late 1990s. Then Israel's Supreme Court outlawed torture, but left the door open to what it called moderate physical pressure. Based on the new ruling, interrogators of Israel's spy agency, Shin Bet, are permitted to use psychological pressure and a moderate degree of physical pressure. This is what Israeli authorities are telling the world, but in practice, the interrogation methods go far beyond a reasonable interpretation of the term moderate physical pressure. Shin Bet claims that these practices are used against detainees to prevent what it calls terrorism, a word which has lost its meaning since it's being used by the Israeli regime and its ilk to justify their crimes against humanity. There are several joint research reports conducted by rights groups based on hundreds of testimonials given by Palestinian prisoners that says Shin Bet routinely employs psychological and physical abuse in interrogations. Their methods combine use of holding conditions and interrogation methods constitutes abuse and inhuman, degrading treatment, at times even amounting to torture. Reports suggest that what is regularly employed against Palestinians in Shin Bet interrogations is in blatant violation of international law and basic moral standards.
We have all these declarations and all these condemnations and all these human rights and international laws, but it is a fact that almost a million Palestinians since 1967 have gone through the interrogations, the tortures, the imprisonment, and that's just the people, and there's the whole families around them.
Palestinians who have undergone such interrogation recounted being held in inhuman conditions, including narrow, windowless cells that are sometimes moldy and foul-smelling. They said the cells were constantly lit with artificial lighting that is painful to the eyes. Some detainees reported being held in solitary confinement, completely cut off from their surroundings. Some reported exposure to extremes of heat and cold, as well as sleep deprivation. Many described abominable hygienic conditions. Among other things, they stated that the prison authorities do not allow them to shower, change clothes, brush their teeth, or even use toilet paper. The food is intentionally poor in quality and quantity, and detainees lose weight while in custody. In the interrogation room, they're forced to sit bound to a chair without moving for hours and even days on end. The interrogators threaten the detainees, including threats to harm their relatives, as well as shouting and employing violence against them.
I suffered from smear campaigns, I suffered from death threats, I suffered from detention, arrest, physical attacks on me. So I was arrested uncountable time now. They used to arrest me 2 times a week or detain me 2 times a day.
There are many Palestinians who have reported severe psychological strain because of torture during their detention, particularly at interrogation centers where they are completely isolated from the outside for long periods. Most Palestinians who are physically or mentally abused in interrogation have no way of complaining until the interrogation is over. This is because Palestinian detainees are regularly denied the right to meet with counsel. In the meantime, the complaints never ended in favor of Palestinians. Just in the past 2 decades, 1,300 torture complaints were filed against Shin Bet, but barely any criminal investigations were launched. Even as investigations deepened, there has still not been a single indictment. Israeli activists, along with Palestinians, have time and again called for independent investigation against Shin Bet and other Israeli policing units for the way they treat Palestinian detainees. So far, most cases are resulting in cleaning Shin Bet's name. With Israel's indifference and the silence of the international community, Palestinian resistance fronts try to take the matter in their own hands. Since 2001, not a single criminal investigation has been launched into a complaint against a Shin Bet interrogator, despite hundreds of complaints being lodged with the relevant authorities. Although formal changes have been made to the apparatus charged with looking into these complaints, so far no real action has been taken to alter the situation. Hundreds of complaints, zero criminal investigations. A report by Palestinian Human Rights released in 2018 shows that more than 200 Palestinians have lost their lives in Israeli prisons since 1967 to torture, lack of medical care, or gunshot wounds.
An Israeli soldier used to step on my leg with his boots and shake my bed to cause me more pain. He kept threatening to send me to prison. I came back and I knew I would lose my leg because it was all black and rotten. I am now living in a prison. I can't walk or move around anymore.
The Palestinian children in military detention is another concerning issue. A report released in July 2018 by the Center for Palestinian Prisoner Studies says that the number of children arrested increased by 30%. Compared to the same period in 2017, when 380 children were arrested by Israeli forces. Multiple rights groups have time and again urged UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to launch a special committee to probe Palestinian deaths in Israeli prisons. But so far, nothing has changed for the Palestinians.
In the limelight.
Indigenous peoples came to COP26 summit in Glasgow with clear goals that we wanted to see reflected in the final results. Now that it is over, we don't see the path forward we were hoping for. There is still too much wrangling between the developed and the developing countries, with the developed nations blocking much-needed agreements on rights and funding. And overall progress towards implementing the commitments made in the Paris Agreement is too slow. The article you're about to hear has been written by Victoria Tauri Corpuz, the director of Tepteba Foundation, Indigenous Peoples International Center for Policy Research and Education in the Philippines. It has been published in the opinion section of the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled Indigenous Peoples Had a Clear Vision for COP26, but it has not been delivered. Indigenous peoples came to COP26 in Glasgow with clear goals that we wanted to see reflected in the final results. But now that it is over, we don't see the path forward that we were hoping for. There is still too much wrangling between the developed and the developing countries, with the developed nations blocking much-needed agreements on rights and funding. And overall progress towards implementing the commitments made in the Paris Agreement is too slow. We wanted to ensure that the decisions included the need to respect human rights, including indigenous peoples' rights, in undertaking adaptation, mitigation, and loss and damage measures to deal with the immediate effects of the climate crisis. We also wanted COP26 to adopt the local communities and indigenous peoples platform, as agreed by the Facilitative Working Group, an initiative that would ensure indigenous peoples and their knowledge would be included in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change process. It is vital that indigenous peoples are able to directly access finance, so that when they undertake actions on the climate crisis, it is from a position of strength, and they are ensured the protection of rights to own, to control and manage territories, especially their forests. It was also our view that Article 6 of the Paris Climate Accord on market and non-market mechanisms for emissions trading and offsets should include us when these are designed and implemented and our rights should be protected. Also, that an international grievance mechanism be established, which we can use in case our rights are violated in the implementation of Article 6 of the Paris Climate Accord. I'm happy to see the preamble of the COP26 cover decision states that parties respect, promote, and consider their respective obligations on human rights, the right to health, the rights of indigenous peoples. This decision also recognizes and acknowledges the important role of stakeholders, including indigenous peoples, in averting, minimizing, and addressing loss and damage associated with the adverse effects of climate change. The decision also recognizes the importance of protecting, conserving, and restoring ecosystems to deliver crucial services, including acting as a net carbon sink, reducing vulnerability to climate change impacts and supporting sustainable livelihoods, including for indigenous peoples and for local communities. when several countries and philanthropic donors committed $1.7 billion to indigenous peoples to protect their forests, I voiced my hope that these resources would be effectively and directly accessed by indigenous peoples and not go through intermediaries such as states or the big conservation organizations. A protocol was adopted, which, if effectively implemented, means indigenous peoples and local communities will be able to further develop and strengthen the use of their traditional knowledge, practices, and innovation on climate change mitigation and adaptation. That decision emphasized the important role of indigenous peoples and local communities, culture, and knowledge in effective action on climate change, urging parties to actively involve indigenous peoples and local communities. Article 6 of the Paris Climate Accord on market and non-market-based mechanisms for mitigation mentions the need to respect indigenous peoples' rights, but does not mention the need to obtain a free, prior, and informed consent. We hoped for an international grievance mechanism, but that was downgraded. So some good was done in Glasgow, but there were many inadequacies, such as the agreement to phase down rather than phase out coal production, even if it was an advance to see coal mentioned for the first time in a COP decision. The biggest coal producers and coal users, such as China, the United States of America, Australia, and India, also did not sign on an earlier pledge to end the use of coal power. With this, it is difficult to imagine that the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature rise goal will be achieved. What we need is for countries who are contributing most to greenhouse gas emissions to be serious in cutting back on fossil fuel production. For us, in developing countries, the capacity of our government to adapt and mitigate is directly dependent on the provision of finance from the rich world. And yet, the commitment to deliver $100 billion every year from 2020 was not reaffirmed. We, the indigenous peoples, will continue to do our duties and fulfill our obligations to Mother Earth and to our future generations. But we will be able to do these much better if our collective rights to our lands, to our territories and resources, to culture and to our traditional knowledge, practices and innovations are respected and protected. Many lives of indigenous leaders and activists have been sacrificed, nurturing the ecosystem the world needs. COP26 summit didn't do enough to set us on a clear path to 1.5 degrees Celsius rise or to allow vulnerable countries and vulnerable people to adapt to the ongoing crisis.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear friends, salam and welcome to this program entitled Muslim Lady. In the studio, we have Dr. Razia Batul Najafi and her husband, Hujjatul Islam Masumi. Both of them are experts on Islamic science. Let's listen to them.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I'm Farman Ali Masumi.
So we are going to talk today about some very, very difficult, challenging issues which a Muslim lady is facing nowadays. We have to see according to the era and the time. Nowadays, in 2021, yeah, what kind of biggest challenges are just waiting for practicing Muslim lady?
Definitely nowadays this world is full of technology, internet, IT, full of, you know, different gadgets and tablets and, you know, phones in your hand.
Exactly, yeah.
So whatever you want, you can do, you know.
Yeah, full of freedom.
Although you are alone sitting in your bedroom, but you are present in front of whole world, you know. So definitely a lot of challenges our sons, our men, they also have, and especially our women, our daughters, they have more challenges, especially an Islamic, you know, wife and daughter.
Yeah,
religious,
you know why? Because
daughter.
Of social. Because we as a women, our area, very sensitive area,
yeah,
is social. You know, socially,
yeah,
how I have to come and present myself, you know.
Yeah.
As a woman, we like to display ourselves, to
yeah,
show our beauty, yeah. And as a man, for men, it is very, very, Islam has restricted,
yeah,
about to see, yeah, to look at,
yeah,
that kind of scenes and beauties. And this is our test, and that
yes,
is your test.
Yeah, definitely. If you do not use the social media nowadays, then people say you are not part of this world. You are something like ignorant and like
backward, out of the society.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're out.
So that is also not good. And if you use social media without limits, freely, with all freedom, this is also very, very harmful.
Wow.
So we
so,
have to
yeah,
balance.
Exactly.
Yeah.